This is Jordan Nanos back again with Hunter Almgren with Things We Read This Week. This week we got a show of updates. We got an update on nuclear power. We got an update on Intel's struggles, trials, and tribulations. We've got an update on AI, maybe going to kill everybody soon, and lots of new stuff as well. But before we get into that, it's been 2 weeks. Hunter, what you been up to?
Surprise AI. No, it's just like, I feel like I'm going to say that every week now, cause that's all I want. That's all anybody wants to talk about. Yeah. No, it's cool. I mean, there's a lot of things going on, right? What's interesting is every single conversation that I have boils down to, I either want to build a RAG app, like a chatbot, or I want to do code assistance. Every single conversation, you know, I get invited to these meetings and presentations that are like, hey, my customer's interested in AI. Okay, great. Like, let's have a conversation. About halfway through the meeting, it boils down to one of those two things each and every time.
Yeah.
And so it's not any wonder why those are the two most popular use cases for generative AI today, at least right now, is because that's all anybody has as an idea of like, hey, this could provide some business value. And I think now that it's at least been a while, we're starting to see customers able to come up with their own KPIs for how they measure business or financial impact, right, of these applications, right? So there's one company that I work with that like actually came to us and said, here's our list of use cases, and then here's the KPIs that we're going to measure by. And I was like blown away, because more often than not, the question that I get is, hey, what are you seeing in this space for like tracking, like let's take code assistance, for example, right? Mm-hmm. What are the KPIs you're using to measure developer productivity improvements, right? Is it number of commits? Is it, you know, number of updates, pushes to new versions? Is it, you know, they're all looking for these metrics, but then you have this, what I'm starting to see is you also now have customers that have figured that out for what makes sense to their business. And they're saying, these are the metrics that we're going to use to track performance improvements or productivity improvements for this given use case, right? And so some are easier, I think, than others, right? So like for automated claims processing in the insurance space, that's a really easy one, right? If the claims adjuster's time to decision gets cut from a week to a day, like that's a really easy math problem, right? Where you can figure out like how much cost savings that is to the business. But I think with like code assistance, it's a little more, there's no hard cost dollar value, I think, that's emerged, right? A lot of it is soft cost, and that's kind of the way that people are tracking is like, you know, time between commits, how many commit, everybody's got a different metric, I think, and nobody's settled on like a generally accepted one, at least from what I've seen so far, but like it's interesting to see, you know, the companies that I talk to starting to figure these metrics out for themselves, which is cool to see.
It's interesting that there's metrics at all. Like the I remember about a year ago I met a startup. I should go find who they are if they're still doing this work. It's early stage, and they were just focused on developer satisfaction or like a happiness index score. Mm-hmm. The assumption being the developers were doing productive work, and if they enjoyed using a tool or a system or something like that, that's a good thing. Coming up with metrics like lines of code is probably a little strange. It's Goodhart's law, right? Like if the metric or the measure becomes a target, it ceases to be either. And I think like AI can just generate a bunch of code and let you push a bunch of lines, you know, a bunch of new blog posts, but where's the quality or whatever there.
Yeah. And I'm not saying any of these metrics are right or wrong at this point, you know, and I agree with you. In fact, like when one customer brought up like number of commits, I'm like, that seems a little micromanagey to me. Like, sir, you only had 26 commits to the repository last week. What are you doing all day? Like,
yeah, If it's a big company, obviously this is kind of impossible, but everybody says, oh, we're a big company, we operate like a startup. Well, one thing that startups do is they kind of just make decisions based on, qualitatively, based on vibes. Hey, my developer seemed to like this thing. Okay, we're going to buy it. Hey, this seems like a good idea. I have good taste. I have some intuition about it. Let's go do it. And applying that to a large company, I think is a huge opportunity. If you just say, hey, everybody seems to like working with a Copilot for coding. We should just roll that thing out and then improve it over time. Like that seems like a good bet right now. It's also interesting that, like, I think we've said this before, but your definition of AI is just software. Like, for a while, I think we've talked about all the buzzwords in AI or in the like general IT industry. I mean, roll it back to .com era buzzword stuff. There was kind of like everybody wants to be on the internet. Everybody wants a website. So you can kind of just simplify the .com boom to bring companies online, give them a website. AI, everybody wants a personal assistant. They want software, and people are using a whole bunch of different buzzwords to describe the behavior of how this software works, how these models work, instead of just being like, we can embed software into this process that we have right now. Carpathy famously called it software 2.0, right? I think it's an accurate description. The software we're going to embed in this process no longer is deterministic. We can't write the rules. Now we just need to train the model, and then it improves. It gets better over time. Pretty cool to see that, like, just being adopted in so many different areas. Okay, so let's get into some articles. Where do you want to start?
Well, I, you know, why don't we start with the first thing you mentioned regarding Intel, right? So, I think shortly after we finished the last episode, this article came out about Qualcomm approaching Intel about a takeover deal. And what was interesting about this was they weren't actually after the foundry. They were after the chips. And of course, Intel responded with a hard no. But what was interesting about this to me is like, remember years back when Intel tried to get into the mobile processing game, right? Like they tried to build chips for phones. Obviously, that didn't go anywhere. They exited the market. Qualcomm similarly has been trying to push more into the data center space. And not, I, as far as I can tell, kind of having a rough go at it, right? So
Kind of,
it's
yeah,
interesting
definitely
is,
having a rough go in the data
yeah,
center business
I'm
right
trying to be a little bit nice, but
now.
it's like both of these companies have tried to basically, break out of their, core business focus area and try to expand into a thing that they really don't know a lot about. So I thought it was interesting that Qualcomm's like, well, we can't break into the data center space, so why don't we just buy the chips to do it? Was their thinking? I don't know. I don't know if that was their thinking or not. It was just kind of a really interesting, like, I could see other people making bids for Intel, whatever, but Qualcomm?
I think it so certainly the data center business makes sense, especially with Qualcomm's market cap being so big and the fact that they're a fabless company. If Intel's market cap is 93 billion, according to this article, for the entire company, and they're going to spin out Foundry, which is about to get tens of billions of dollars of subsidies from the government to build a Foundry, implying that if it doesn't have negative enterprise value, it's worth tens of billions of dollars at least. You're coming under 80, 70, coming towards 50, 60 range for the fabless business at Intel. If you look at, and I don't know what the offer was from Qualcomm or how it was structured, obviously, but if it's just a rumor, but like, let's break down what Intel has in the portfolio because we kind of been ragging on them a little bit. So, like, from laptops to PCs to tablets, they make chips for consumer devices. They make data center chips like x86. They have a almost them and Intel have a, or sorry, them and AMD have a duopoly over the server chips
right.
in the x86 market, which is still much larger than ARM or RISC-V. They've got an entire like IoT group that does things at the edge, systems on a chip and whatever. That's valuable even if it gets spun off. They've got the entire Optane thing, persistent memory, the NVMe drives,
no,
that stuff.
The drives, I'm pretty sure they sold those to Solidigm.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure they exited that. They exited that market a couple years back, I think.
Okay. They certainly still got IP around the Optane products that they killed, like the persistent memory stuff, right?
Yeah. That was a joint venture with Micron, I believe.
Yeah. They stopped producing it, but still sell it or something like that, because they've just got a bunch sitting in a warehouse.
Yeah. Fire sale.
They've got the, you know, formerly Nirvana FPGA stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then it, almost most importantly for this AI boom, they've got Gaudi. Like, they acquired Habana and they have Gaudi 3 that's coming out. And I have to, like, that's hundreds of millions of dollars of business that they've been selling. So, I mean, you add up all of that. I would argue that even just the x86 monopoly is valuable to the tune of tens of billions of dollars. And you just look at all the IP, all the people, and you're like, there's something here for sure. Right?
Yeah.
I don't know.
There is.
So it makes sense, hey, if Qualcomm can come in with a financial position to think they can turn the business around in some way, it's kind of just like a private equity buyout, but you're strategic. So I don't know.
Yeah.
Whatever.
I don't think it's going to happen, right? I mean, I don't think Intel's going to sell to anybody, right? I mean, I think that Pat's sticking with his, what he's already said publicly his plan is to turn it around, is like, we're going to spin off Foundry, right? We're going to get rid of that. And then we're going to focus on our core business, which is making chips, right? Designing chips.
I think this is the best of Intel for the industry at large. I would like to see a strong, fabulous Intel designing great x86 chips and taking Gaudi forward. That's mm-hmm. exciting to me.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And I mean, just the early information and presentations that I've seen from Intel on Gaudi 3, I mean, it is interesting, right? I mean, it does. The other thing that I thought was interesting with their messaging is I've noticed that they've kind of, and maybe it was just the specific person that I saw present this, but, you know, this person seemed to indicate that, like, people want to move towards smaller models and do inference on CPU, right? Like, they don't want to, you know, always, like, not everyone needs an H100 is their position, right? Like, they don't think that a lot, you know, they think that the majority of the use cases that people are doing, if it's just a simple inference use case where I'm downloading a model, small model off of Hugging Face, and by small, I mean, like, think like 1, 2, 3 billion parameters, right?
Yeah.
And I'm just taking that off the shelf, barely doing anything to it, and here's my simple use case. Like, that can be done on a CPU, is their argument. More specifically, their upcoming CPU launch of Granite Rapids.
Yeah, I mean, 100%, man. So, like, let's switch to a little bit. I mean, I don't think we're planning to cover this because we can't cover every single LLM release, but this is a pretty big one for what you just brought up. Llama 3.2 came out last week. The 3 billion parameter version of this model with 5-shot MMLU is over 60 points, which is like, I mean, this is GPT-3 class
mm-hmm.
when it was first released in a 3 billion parameter model. 1B is just below that at 49.3. So, like, you know, half correct on these, you know, like knowledge-based questions.
Yeah.
An assistant that helps you write a blog post, that helps you edit an email, that helps you, you know, write a performance review, that helps you, like, translate something running on device on the second tab I've got pulled up here, which is like the Intel Lunar Lake release. I mean, that's like, it's kind of blowing it away, right?
Yeah.
You can have a a laptop that sits on your desk that runs a model that's personalized, that's completely disconnected and controls all of your information. I mean, at a high level, that makes a lot of sense for consumers. Mm-hmm. I then go, is this a massive business opportunity for the chip makers or for the model makers?
Yeah.
3.2, Llama 3.2 is open source. It's quite good right now. These Lunar Lake chips need to be priced like any other laptop if they're going to sell. I don't know if people will pay a premium, pay any premium just to get a, you know, LLM capable laptop.
It'll be very interesting to see like how this stuff gets priced. And, you know, Microsoft is doing the whole Copilot PC certified or whatever, right? Like where you've got your regular desktop and laptop, and then you have an optimized one for Copilot, and I'll be interested to see if anybody wants to pay the premium for that, or if they're just like, why would I do this?
Yeah. So we went this way with, like Chromebooks, right?
Yeah.
So yep. the web browser started making laptops. Not really, but and now are we going to have a ChatGPT laptop versus a Gemini laptop versus a Claude laptop versus a Llama laptop? Like, I mean, we've got Microsoft tablets, we've got Chromebooks, we've got like people trying to cut into the Dell, HP, Acer, Lenovo, MacBook thing. I honestly have a feeling that the laptops, people do this in terms of the phone, right? Mm-hmm. They've been saying, oh, ChatGPT on the phone, we're going to have Apple Intelligence. But the form factor, unless you're talking to it, doesn't make a lot of sense because it's slow for me to type with my thumbs. I think a laptop with a camera that can see what's going on around me, with a microphone that I can also type on and like fully manipulate with keystrokes, way more faster, way more natural than trying to interact with one of these models over a phone.
Yeah.
And much more in most of these use cases with these models, it seems like it's productivity based in a like knowledge worker type of a setting. You're sitting at a desk, right? You're not like on the go.
Well, and which, by the way, Llama Top has a really nice ring to it, so I think I'm going to go ahead and trademark that just before anybody else steals it.
Better than Lap Llama, eh?
Yeah. I think what I'm most interested in watching is like, obviously, Apple's focused on smaller models that run on device, right? That's the whole thing with Apple Intelligence. And the way that they're going about doing it is not like necessarily a chat style interface, but more like you interface with the model with Siri, right? So like you're talking to it, right? Or you're like, you know, as you're using your phone, let's say you get an email with a calendar or an email reminding you of something that you have to do, right? It auto creates something in your calendar that says, do this, right? Like do stuff like that, right? Where you're not typing out these long prompts and hoping for a response. You're more just like, oh, Apple Intelligence found this thing in your inbox. Would you like me to create a calendar invite for it? And you just click yes, right? Like that's how you're interfacing with the small model. Mm-hmm. So from that perspective, I guess, yeah, I see the benefit to models that run on device. Plus, then Apple can claim all these security features and, you know, your data stays here and it's private and all that, you know, fun stuff. I just don't know the application, you know, going back to what Intel is stating about, hey, you know, inference can be run on CPU with Xeon 6. We'll see, right? Like, we'll see if a enterprise production scale inference workload will do just fine on x86.
Yeah, I think it a lot's hinging on that word enterprise in there. We'll see exactly what those use cases are. it's hard for me to imagine a world where everybody's making API calls for every single task they want to do. Like, it's got to run locally for a lot of this stuff.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of API calls, there's a big data center build out that we also have been talking about a lot, and I'll jump over to that one. There was a list of different nuclear power buildouts that are happening right now. We covered the restart of Three Mile Island a little bit. Mm-hmm. And this guy, Alex Stapp on Twitter, had four screenshots in a tweet I'm going to go find right now, where he covers the different companies that are investing in nuclear. He says AI plus nuclear is on fire right now. And the four articles are: Oracle is designing a data center that would be powered by three small nuclear reactors. I think we talked about that.
We did. We talked about the first two or three.
Three Mile Island, restarted by Microsoft. Yeah. Amazon just bought a 100% nuclear powered data center. Google CEO eyeing electricity from nuclear plants. I guess Sundar is just jumping on the bandwagon. Another guy says Amazon is now hiring nuclear engineers. Mark Nelson says this at Energy Bants on Twitter. He also says, Europeans, if we force everyone to wash their clothes by hand, they won't need gym memberships to get exercise. Americans, let's literally restart Three Mile Island nuclear plant. So, yeah, nuclear is on fire, man.
It is. And, you know, what's funnier about it is it's not even the hyperscalers. Now we're talking server makers also buying these microgrids. Like, the people who are making the systems that people are using to put in these data centers somehow also need these microgrids.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm assuming, right? Like, a lot of this has to do with the ability to do things like cluster integration and testing, right? You know, when you build these large scale systems for these people, there's typically if you're not familiar with the process, right? Like, there's a period of the agreement called an acceptance period, right? This is where you, as the manufacturer, stand up this big system in your manufacturing floor. You allow your end customer to log into it and verify that all of the performance and everything else that you said is going to be there, right? That's very common in the national lab HPC space, right? Every single one of the, you know, Frontier, Aurora, right? Like, they've all gone through this acceptance testing. And so is it
And part that? Of that happens in the factory and part of that happens on site, right?
Correct. So, yes.
Quanta, being a Taiwanese company that's going to manufacture systems, needs some power to start up, you know, a 1024 GPU cluster, a 2048 GPU cluster, even if it's for a week, to do a burn-in. Mm-hmm. and test the system. I think this one's a little unique just because it's Taiwan and the grid operates a little bit differently there. When TSMC needs power and it's a hot day in the summer, they just tell the citizens, you're not getting any AC and you're not allowed to take a hot shower for a little while, because, you know, we're collectivist and we're going to contribute to the performance of the national semiconductor manufacturing company. So I think that's a little bit different, but it's totally the trend is, grids are being stressed because people need more power.
Yep.
And there's all of these different charts of just, like, there's never been an advanced society that consumes little power. It's like, as energy goes up, society advances. If we want to do these more advanced things with these chatbots and coding assistants and whatever, we're going to consume a lot more power, whether it's in the form of, like, a couple of chips on your washing machine, or chips in your laptop, or servers in a data center. It's
or
just
your refrigerator,
like,
now. You know, we definitely need object recognition in our refrigerators now to see whether we're almost out of milk or not from an app on our phone, because everyone needs that.
To decide whether we need it or not, we're going to get it You're going to be happy about it.
I know.
It's so funny. Yeah. So I'm thinking so much about this podcast that Dwarkesh Patel had with Asianometry and Dylan Patel from Semianalysis.
Mm-hmm.
And at one point in the podcast, I think Dylan was like, why does my Tesla need four chips in the door?
Yeah.
Like, you remember when these, yep. You know, the semiconductor manufacturing industry grinds to a halt, shipments around the world are troubled, and these are these incredibly complex supply chains during COVID, and now we can't ship cars. It's because there's all of these empty chassis with engines with, you know, seats and steering wheels and no electronics.
Well, I remember, who was it? Was it Stellantis or Ford? One of the two, they just started selling the cars without the technology in it. So, you know, Blue Cruise doesn't work, you know, Apple CarPlay, Android Auto doesn't work, but the car drives, right? Like, it functions. And then whenever we get the chips, bring it into the dealership and we'll install them for you. Like, that's kind of the approach that they ended up having to take. And I remember seeing like drone shots of mm-hmm. like these massive parking lots filled with brand new cars that had no chips just sitting there. Like,
yeah, well, it led to Toyota, right, developing this like concept truck that has no electronics in it.
Mm-hmm.
Like manual windows and doors and a key or whatever.
Crank windows. I haven't seen those in a minute.
Yeah, well, yeah. yeah, I don't know. It hasn't been that recent, I guess. But yeah, moving trucks, definitely. I got in a U-Haul with crank windows and a nice radio. That was fun. I was like, yeah, bring your own Bluetooth speaker into the car. was the feeling that I had. But I mean, one of the benefits of this pickup truck is going to be a work truck. It's like, it's going to be cheap. It's going to be like the equivalent of $10,000 for a work truck. I'm like, am I really paying half of the price of a modern vehicle? It's like, obviously, yeah, there's these displays. There's all these, you know, chips all over the car. Anyway, I'm not going to be a technophobe, but that's also reminding me of different perspectives. It's like, there's a lot of software engineers and people who understand technology really closely who like to, you know, go on off the grid camping trips for 2 weeks at a time and like have manual locks on their door and no smart devices in the home and stuff like that.
It's like, dude, I'm kind of there, honestly. Like, you know, for a long time, like, I'll pay more to have a non-intelligent appliance. Like, I really don't care. Like, I will literally pay extra money to not have a fucking app control my oven. Like, you know, like, when I'm done working, right? When I'm done talking about technology all day, the last thing I want to do is interface with an app to cook dinner. Like, pass. Super pass. Like, I feel like I'm one of those people to a degree. And like, even when my wife and I have gone on vacation, right? Like, we'll go to places like Estes Park, Colorado, which is right outside the national park. And there's no cell service, none, zero. Like, you couldn't use your phone even if you wanted to. And like, we're in a cabin, we're by a, you know, a fast moving stream. Like, there's just something peaceful to, at least to me, about being completely disconnected. Right. And just like being in that moment.
Totally, man. Yeah. We're going to pay a premium, drive all this way to have these curated natural experiences.
Honestly,
turn
what
off
they,
the phone.
Dude, a great business model, like literally just build a warehouse that's like, you know, got some different things, activities that people can do that aren't tech related. And then just build the whole building like a Faraday cage. Like, so you walk in, you're just cut off, man.
Mr.
Like, you're
Beast,
just, that's
where
it.
You at, man?
Yeah,
Mr.
like,
Beast.
That's it, man. Like, you have no more connectivity to the outside world. Like, you got to live here in this moment.
Yeah. Okay, well, in the spirit of doomerism and anti-technology vibes, I'll move us on to another story. AI not kill everyone is a memes on Twitter posts a screenshot of somebody who says, I think I'm working for an AI. responded to a ChatGPT or a Craigslist ad, and basically says, "Yeah, I do get paid, but there's a 3 to 4 second delay every time I'm talking to this guy on the phone, and anytime I get a call, I get a response. He's in a meeting, and okay, you get a Cash App, Zelle, or PayPal when he gets the work done." The work kind of is basically simple. It's like take pictures of a home for a listing, right? Mm-hmm. Seems relatively straightforward, and maybe it's like kind of a commodity work. Yeah. But that one was one of the first ones that really rubbed me the wrong way of having people working for, like, unknowingly, I think is the important piece, unknowingly working for an LLM. And it's a busy person augmented by an LLM. So, you know, clearly they're, well, not clearly, maybe they're working for a person who's using an LLM. Where do you draw that line of like, hey, I've sent some emails I've had some writing assistance from an LLM for sure. But, you know, what's that level of automation where it flips over into being scary?
Well, and not only that, right? Like, how did we get to this point where we went from Amazon's Mechanical Turk, which is just paying people to like label and classify images and stuff like that for use in LLMs and other AI use cases, to now we're the ones taking the pictures and generating the content for the LLM. Like, that's wild to think about. Like, Amazon's Mechanical Turk's like model just like flipped itself, you know?
Yeah. Well, and that's a perfect segue, because the other one I wanted to share was a project reporting around a project that Scale AI did with Meta. You know, there's been a lot of reports about how people training these language models are effectively constrained based on the amount of data they have. And so they turn to solutions like synthetic data generation, have a language model generate data that another model trains on. And you were saying Amazon Mechanical Turk, Scale AI is famously the first one to put an API in front of a human being, make an API call, pay some money, and then somebody will go and label things. They'll draw a bounding box around an object in an image. They'll answer a question. In some cases, they'll solve some complicated math problem or some complicated physics problem, and now you've got tiers of who you're paying for to train a model to do these sorts of things. The problem is that in this report, many answers sounded the same or began with the phrase, as an AI language model. So even though somebody's paying Scale to generate these things, and theoretically this is a human-generated answer to a given question, you can't always verify that those contractors or those people that are generating the answers are not themselves using a language model, right? Cutting some corners. Right. So it's language models all the way down. Maybe we've got, you know, bosses that are using the LLM to employ people who are then, you know, in this guy's case where he's taking pictures of homes, can he go and prompt Midjourney to get a couple of pictures of homes and then send them back to the guy and ask if those passed the smell test? You know, we've got
for sure
AIs paying each other. Then I'm looking for a new home. I'm using an AI to scan the different websites for something in the 2-bed, 2-bath range. It's a brave new world.
It is. Yeah. People using AI to do jobs that AI is paying them for.
Yeah.
I feel like, I don't know, I feel like something's going to happen. I don't know what, but I feel like when you start getting into that, it's almost like a fight fire with fire scenario, like where like I'm using AI to do, and this has actually been something that's been very helpful with like what Big Idea is doing, which I think I talked about on another podcast, and what like Tamer and some of these other companies are doing, where like they're using AI to classify and categorize and clean up data to prep it for AI. Mm-hmm. Right. So like that piece of it, I think, is super helpful. But like somebody answering a, you know, Craigslist post of like, go take pictures of these houses. And then they go out to Stable Diffusion and say, generate me a picture of a house in a neighborhood with these parameters, and then sends that to the AI and says, here you go. Here's your pictures of a house. Like, I didn't have to leave my desk. That's interesting.
So did you see the stuff on Notebook LM from Google?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. So I didn't have this one on the docket or anything, but I'm going to bring up a tweet from Andre Karpathy. He's probably been the biggest promoter of Notebook LM. So just to talk about this, what is the difference between creation and curation? If you're using an AI, I think he's saying he describes it as curation rather than creation. He specifically went and said that over the last 2 hours, he curated a new podcast of 10 episodes called Histories of Mysteries using the Notebook LM service from Google, which if you haven't used it, it basically punch in a PDF, a website, a transcript of a YouTube video, it doesn't matter. And it will create, you know, things like flashcards or quiz questions or a podcast, a really engaging podcast between, you know, an AI-generated female voice and an AI-generated male voice where they talk about the subject. And man, it's like really good to learn about. So he has a 10-episode podcast about everything from the lost city of Atlantis to the Roanoke colony to WoW Signal, 10 different mysteries, I guess, he's interested in. And having just used this Notebook LM service to create a podcast about a friend of mine joined a new company, and I didn't want to read through the whole website and all these blogs about what the company does. I created a 15-minute podcast about the company, learned like so much while I was doing the dishes. So, I mean, Notebook LM makes a lot of sense to me. And there's a lot of people, I think, get really concerned right away. Okay, AI is generating slop, and there's no humans on the internet anymore. I'm going to learn a lot from a podcast just like this, or make some for my own. And then I'm going to see my friends, and I'm going to talk about some mysteries I learned about, or I'm going to know more about my buddy's company.
Mm-hmm.
As long as we still got opportunities to apply this stuff in real life, we're still going out for dinner, we're still calling a friend, recording a podcast like we're doing right now.
Yeah.
I think we'll be okay. Hopefully we'll be okay.
I agree. Now, what would be really funny is to use Notebook LM to recreate this podcast and see how much different it is than what we could talk about as an experiment.
We're going to punch in the last few episodes and have these two people go back and forth reviewing what we've talked about. Oh, man.
Wouldn't
yeah,
that
you
be
can edit the prompt to make them be like extra critical or extra nice or something.
Uh-huh.
So
yeah.
Oh boy, we've got our own like Michelin star food reviewer style takedown of our podcast or some like Rotten Tomatoes review.
Yeah, just a brutally scathing version of our podcast that just rips on everybody. Like, this would be so good. I think I want to do it as an experiment at some point. And it doesn't have to be, you know, now or in the near future, but I think maybe as things slow down towards the holiday season, like, that would be an interesting experiment to do.
Well, yeah.
And if we do it, we will provide updates.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Let me finish with one comment about Notebook LM. It's somebody said it was a ChatGPT moment for them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think your mind immediately goes to virality, but the specific details was like, this was released as a relatively low key research preview. And I think the ChatGPT for me as somebody who used like the Playground website with the GPT-3 model with just the completions thing before they did the instruction fine tuning and before they like released ChatGPT, I was like, wow, this is cool, but really didn't use it much. I feel like that just happened for Gemini's 1.5 million long context window. Just something that they can do that other people can't because of the TPU. We've got this special hardware. We can effectively give you an infinite context window. It makes it really cheap. And now we can do this Notebook LM stuff where it's like the limit is 50 files to punch in to an in-context generation. And I haven't read through all the files in detail, but there hasn't been a single thing that's come up in that little summary or that little podcast where I've been like, this is BS, or I've said it
or it's incorrect or something. Yeah.
In context, reasoning seems like pretty good. It's not rag. It's not like, you know, pulling the wrong chunk or hallucinating. It's like, it's all grounded. So, I thought that was a great summary, and it's just pretty exciting to see that, like, the innovation on this stuff still comes from a great front end user experience that can be released for free as a low key research preview. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, Google's kicking themselves, like, probably could have made a lot of money if we had some good demos of this thing.
Yeah, you know? Absolutely.
Not that they need the money, but we covered that last week anyway. All right, you give me one now.
Well, we have an update actually on the Supermicro situation, because the saga just continues week after week. So obviously we had the Hindenburg Research article, which we talked about, and then on another episode we talked about Supermicro's response to that, and then on another episode we talked about the fallout from it, and kind of, you know, federal government saying they're no longer going to do business with them until this is resolved and blah, 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 right? Well, now we have an update that apparently the Hindenburg Research article was not BS, and the U.S. Department of Justice has opened a probe into the company to see how true these claims actually are. I have one response to this. Usually when the Department of Justice gets involved, this is the end result.
Yeah. For those listening, Hunter is showing a GIF of that with the caption, cavity searches for everyone from, what is this, King of the Hill?
No, it's the movie Beavis and Butthead Do America.
Oh, Beavis and Butthead. Oh, my judge.
Yeah. It was literally the first thing that I thought of. And I forget, I think it's Robert Stack who does the voice of that character in that movie. It's just so good because he's like, go deep and hard on him in like that. So I'm interested to see the results of the DOJ's investigation into this, because, you know, what I always want to know is, like, when short sellers release these articles, a lot of people jump and rush to, like, oh, this is a hit piece, like, you know, you obviously have an open short position against these, you know, this company, like, you're trying to manipulate the stock so that you make money on your short position. But then, as we covered on an earlier episode, a lot of the stuff specifically that Hindenburg had done had turned out to be true and resulted in crazy things like shootouts and standoffs and what have you, right? So I'll be really interested to keep following this and see. I'm not going to spend too much time on it. I actually wanted to shift gears a little bit, going back to what we were talking about regarding chips, and talk about Cerebras filing their IPO, right?
Yeah. Not only has the, like, this is cool because the IPO market has been closed for so long for, like, just about everybody. There's all these charts of, like, no IPOs last year and, like, zero this year. But the one that's going to do it is capitalizing on the hype that's happening right now, AI chips, right? So, okay, Hunter, what would you like to say about this one?
So,
I'm leading the witness here.
No, I know. I think it's cool that they're starting an IPO, right? Like, I've definitely been keeping track of, like, what Tenstorrent is doing, what Cerebras is doing, what, somebody brought up, Grok, somebody brought up Etched to me with their Sohu accelerator. I've been watching
Gaudi still operates like a startup for sure.
100%.
GraphCore is kind of floundering. There's lots of chip makers that that got into AI before the LLM thing and now are trying to, like, extend their capital enough to take advantage of this, right? Make a few modifications maybe, but, like, kind of double down.
Yeah, and I mean, what was super hilarious to me about this is like immediately after this is published, you know, the next platform comes in with, well, yeah, of course they need to IPO. They have one customer. Oh, I love it, man. It's like everyone's celebrating this IPO, and it's like, well, yeah, of course, they need Wall Street's money because they're going to be insolvent with one single customer.
This is like, yeah, this is like the coolest technology ever for people who are into chips, a wafer scale chip of CPU cores ripping and just a bunch of SRAM, but like gigabytes of it. And it works for a lot of stuff. It works, but it's definitely a never been done before business, you know, IPO with one customer sort of thing. I don't know.
I know, but then again, like I do know some, like, you know, I think the University of Illinois National Computing Science Center or whatever, they have one. You know, I know that like there are, I have run
Pittsburgh
into
has
them
one, right?
before.
USC has one. Yeah.
I definitely have run into them before, and they're being actively used. It's not like they're just sitting there idle, right?
100%. Yeah. Researchers love this thing. That's not a business, right? That's testing,
For
beta
sure.
customer sort of stuff with respect, right? I mean, this is the coolest thing ever, like I said, but so in a weird way, my mind goes to SpaceX. It's like they have an incredible business selling to one customer, the US federal government, launching the most complicated technology to the moon or to the ISS or whatever mission these guys want to go for, right? And then on the side, they spun out this Starlink satellite business that is kind of self-fulfilling or self-maintaining. And so my mind goes to, okay, if Cerebras can raise capital, can they have a more, you know, regular enterprise or consumer business for this AI thing, because they're, you know, they've got an incredible engineering team from hardware through to the, you know, like system level software components, libraries, you know, they do all this optimization. And the result is this incredible product for the researchers on the leading edge. Well, okay, that's a very lumpy, very kind of fickle business. And being the like, being the most niche, unique member of a business called supercomputing, which is already lumpy and hard to operate in as a public company, and then deciding we need to go public is like, that seems crazy. So,
It does.
I don't know. Raising money, probably a good thing. Letting people get in on AI hype, good thing. Love the fact that Cerebras exists and is doing this big stuff, and people are training big models on it. Want NVIDIA to have more competition, et cetera, et cetera. That's all good stuff.
So, speaking of
It's
big
also, it
models,
leads me to believe if they prep for public offering, sorry to
that's
keep going on
okay.
this. If they prep for IPO, no company plans to get acquired. Every company plans for IPO. There's a lot of intellectual property in that company. And there's a lot of bigger companies that could come for them, right? So,
Oh
prepping
yeah,
for IPO
especially
is just a
with
good thing to do, probably, to round out all the financials of a business.
well, and especially with all of the, you know, we've covered this in previous episodes about Microsoft making their own chips. Google's obviously got their TPUs. AWS has got their own chips, right? Like, could we see somebody like Meta snapping these guys up to train the next generation of Llama models, for example, right?
We
You know, just.
just talked about how Gemini's differentiator is the long context window that depends on the TPU, right? So
Exactly.
somebody trains a 10 trillion, 100 trillion parameter model. They need fast inference and they need 100 gigs of SRAM. Well, these are probably the industry leaders of designing a chip with 100 gigs of SRAM, getting it to produce wafer scale. So yeah, that's exciting. Anyway. All right, moving on.
Yeah, moving on. So big news about OpenAI. you know, removing their nonprofit control and starting to give Sam Altman equity. I feel like with everything that happened with OpenAI, with Sam getting kicked out, and then there was like some sort of coup, and then he was brought back in, like, you know, I feel like all of that, you know, what came out of that was the other members being mad at Sam. Well, one of the things was, at least from what I observed, is like the other members were mad at Sam for basically building a path to where OpenAI is no longer a nonprofit and they're a for-profit company and they make, you know, ridiculous mountains of cash. And now we're starting to see that actually happen.
Yeah, it seemed inevitable. It's kind of surreal to see it actually happening, though.
I know.
I agree.
I know. I was like, you kind of thought
about
it. Well,
the way
like,
it
oh,
happened,
yeah,
there's no real like head faking and PR campaign that's happening right now. Mm-hmm. If anything, this company is like the weirdest two things. It's like the most successful startup of all time. Rocketing, if you just look at valuation, of course, but even just the speed that revenue's grown or the speed that the user base is growing, most successful of all time. And it's probably the largest exodus of executives in a startup at ever. Like, everybody's gone. In the announcement that Sam made when Mira and I think the guy's name was Jan, who left. When that came out, the text said, like, this person is being promoted as, like, head of research. And I'm like, I've never seen this name before. Who is this person?
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
What do you do?
They're much smarter than me. They're doing great stuff. But, like, I thought I was following this stuff closely. I know who a lot of the players are, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it does kind of remind me of the attention is all you need paper from Google, where there's that overlay of like the eight authors and they all are at startups. None of them remained at Google. So yeah, it definitely feels like a lot of people who are part of this sort of company on the way up get these ideas of like, we could be doing this if they would just listen to me. We could be doing it this way. And then there's a lot of people who are willing to fund them or give them a job to go pursue that idea they want to work on.
Yeah.
So it's crazy that it's like happening in public and there isn't a big PR campaign going on before people quit.
Oh yeah. No, it's just like, it's one of those things that's like, who just quit recently? Like, 2 days ago.
Mira, the CTO, or the
most the CTO, yeah.
Mira Murati, yeah.
It was just like an article drop, like, oh yeah, leaving, right, quitting. Like, that was it. There was no PR, there was no attempt to spin it. It was just deuces.
Yeah.
Like, to your point.
Yeah, which, you know, you can speculate on a lot of things, but let's tie it all back. So OpenAI's effectively got a venture partner with full control named Microsoft.
Mm-hmm.
And they power a lot of Microsoft's offerings. We talked about this on the last episode. If they're going to go bigger and they're going to train a 10 trillion parameter model with 10x more data, they're going to need 100x more compute, 10 times 10. So that means that the roughly $1 billion cluster that's been rumored that they're using right now goes to $100 billion.
Yep.
This is not possible with venture funding, and it's not possible as a nonprofit. It's possible as basically one of five public companies in the U.S., or sovereign nations, if they decide to do it, to invest $100 billion in something with effectively no ROI in sight. I mean, you can make a case, but this is all unknown. it's not like you're buying $100 billion of real estate at the fair market price.
Right. Right.
You're buying $100 billion of GPUs and data center power at the fair market price, minus some amount for a few people or whatever, right? And it's like, okay, who is comfortable converting $100 billion of cash into an asset called NVIDIA Blackwell GPUs and nuclear power reactors? And it's like, Microsoft's comfortable doing that. So therefore, how can OpenAI bring closer ties to Microsoft? I think that's what's happening with the conversion to for-profit. It's obviously what happened with Inflection getting like pseudo acquired by them, where, you know, all the people go there, but then the company as a shell of its former self kind of continues to operate as a friendly, probably still owning the GPUs or something like that. So,
yeah. And you actually sent me what, you know, we're talking about with Dwarkesh Patel saying like, there's no way that OpenAI can pay for these clusters unless they raise $50 to $100 billion. And then, you know, I think a day later after you sent me this, looks like Microsoft's investing $100 billion in data centers. So it's like, it's very clear what's happening here, right? I mean, the dollar amounts are identical. It's not really hard to put two and two together.
Well, this is the interesting thing. So if you were to go back at OpenAI 2 years ago, you might be able to say that GPT-4, the weights, like the model file, the pickle file, or the bin, or the safe tensors. I'm sure they're not using Hugging Face, but like, you know, there's a binary file on a server that is worth $10 billion at that time, right? Because like this training run was spectacular. And then slowly over a year, year and a half, people left, people got acquired, researchers figured it out for themselves at Google and at Meta. And now all of a sudden there are multiple of those pickle or safe tensor files in the industry on different servers. And then Llama 3 comes out and now that file is open source. Mm-hmm. And so no longer the file is valuable, right? The training run is not valuable. It's now the skills to do the next training run. And that's my opinion. My opinion is that the value of OpenAI was tied up in the skills to do the next training run. I don't believe that if everybody's producing these models, it can't be that the existing model weights or the like knowledge of setting up the architecture and the data itself is that valuable.
Right.
It has to be a skill set of people, and now the people are gone. So it's either if you're making this investment as Microsoft, you're either betting on the OpenAI team to run the next training run, or you're betting on the capture of the existing user base.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think in two ways, this is like disproven. One, Google has trained frontier models on non-NVIDIA GPUs, and Llama exists on NVIDIA GPUs, which are like close to OpenAI. They're not ahead of O1 preview, but they're close. See, I don't think you can make that bet on the team. And then the second thing is the user base. And it's like, Anthropic's revenue has grown so much recently, and you literally just change your API key from OpenAI to Anthropic, drop in support for the OpenAI client. Every complicated application you've built on top of the API can be converted to Anthropic.
Yep.
And the split, I'll go try and find the chart, but I don't have it. But basically, OpenAI has a very big split between, it's like a lot of consumer revenue and a lot of enterprise revenue using the API. Anthropic is like all people using the API, basically nobody paying for the Claude like consumer app, $20 a month Claude premium subscription or whatever it's called. So I think that proves that like the API business at OpenAI is not durable. And
right.
So I don't understand $100 billion on the skill set of the team to run the next training run and then be some edge on data, some edge on the existing user base, likely built on a case of Microsoft having a large user base, but somebody's not making an ROI case here. They're making a vibes case of like, this is protection, this is defensive, we need to just be part of this or else we're going to die as a company.
Yeah, and I just, like, to your point, right, like I'm not seeing the, we talked about this on the last episode about needing a 10x multiple, right, for an investment. You're telling me that this investment that Microsoft is making of $100 billion is going to 10x?
I do. I think it's, I actually, at the very high level, I think it's possible for Microsoft to make a $100 billion investment and add $1 trillion of market cap, going from $3 trillion to $4 trillion. Mm. I do think that's possible. And if you're going to make a $100 billion investment right now, I think the investment in AI makes sense. I think the specific investment of buying Blackwell generation NVIDIA GPUs next year, powering on a bunch of nuclear reactors, and letting the training run rip, I don't believe that's going to add the $1 trillion then, based on the vibes I get from using the models right now. I think you wait, you bide your time, you see Llama 4, you see O1 developments, mm-hmm. and then you effectively launch a thing later. But Dylan Patel talked about Microsoft. I mean, we know they're turning on the Three Mile Island nuclear plants. They've got these plans to build out, and they're also laying massive amounts of fiber between data centers.
Yeah.
Right. So this is, to criticize the point I just made, kind of think out loud here. This is a multi-year process just to do the $100 billion training run in 3 years. You've got to start firing up nuclear plants and laying fiber now, because you're going to use multiple data centers across the U.S.
Right.
And you're going to need to start lobbying state governments, local governments, federal governments.
Dude, getting contractors, all that stuff, right? Like, you know, hiring people like what Amazon is doing to assess different, like, power options. You know, what's interesting too about this is, like, okay, so Amazon's going to hire nuclear engineers to assess their, you know, their go forward strategy for nuclear power.
Yeah.
Now Microsoft is laying fiber. At what point do these companies have to be everything, right? They have to be a power company. They have to be a telco. They have to be a, like, you know, like, at what point do we see this convergence of, instead of Microsoft going to a Verizon or a Comcast or somebody and saying, give me all of the fiber that you have, it's, we're going to lay it ourselves and we're going to manage and operate that fiber network.
Well, I think we're kind of answering the question about why does everybody at OpenAI leave. These researchers who want to work on AGI are not interested in becoming a pseudo government entity that runs all of these different utilities just to do the $100 billion training run. They want to work on model architecture. They want to talk to customers and work on user experience. You know, they want to work on data. They want to do research, basically, right?
Yeah.
They don't want to do operations. And that's, I guess they're shifting from, they want to stick in founder mode, not shift into manager mode, right?
Yeah.
but the other thing that occurred to me here that I think is not being considered appropriately, when we say $100 billion investment, or I say $100 billion investment, I was imagining CapEx, $100 billion up front. And I think this is actually spread over 3 years. We're talking mm-hmm. about roughly 30 a year for 3 years before this run works. And it when people say 100 billion, you know, these GPUs, you amortize them over their life cycle. It's 5 years plus. The fiber has many, many years of life cycle. You need power every year.
Right.
There's growth in Azure to grow into the power that, you know, maybe gets used after this training run happens. I actually think you can easily make a case for $20 billion a year for 5 years invested in AI right now. Like, I would be surprised if Microsoft was not increasing their investment in AI by 20. It's just a matter of deploying $100 billion of CapEx a year that I think mm-hmm. would be largely unsustainable, but still doable. I mean, they could take on debt and go for $100 billion. But I don't know. I kind of am realizing that we're armchair finances here are not really thinking about this the same way that Microsoft's CFO is, if somebody comes to them and says, I want to buy a bunch of chips and start up some power plants.
Yeah, of course not. I mean, they're obvious, you know, that's why they get paid to do what they do, is because they could do a much better job than, you know, simple napkin math on a podcast.
Yeah, well, I was inspired by what's the quote from Dwarkesh Dillon and John from Asianometry? There's no way that OpenAI can pay for clusters planned to be built next year unless they raise $50 to $100 billion. And then, quote, rip that bong, baby. Why don't they just go? They got to believe GPT-5 is going to be an order of magnitude better. Scaling allows hold. 10x data, 10x parameters. I just, I don't understand. I guess I got to figure this out. I don't understand how they're going to distill or quantize this model so that it can actually respond. It really is like, you know, Cerebrus. We need 100 gigs of SRAM to run this run one forward pass of this thing once it actually gets trained. Like, you're going to wait 10 seconds for one token on the response? I don't understand how inference works. But I guess they'll figure it out. They've been doing it so far.
So I think...
time to go for a wrap.
Yeah, I think what I wanted to wrap on, and just kind of keeping with this little tradition we started of like amusing things. And this just came out this morning. You know, even the godmother of AI, Fei-Fei Li, has no idea what AGI is.
Oh, boy.
And in fact, if you actually scroll down through this article, the quote is, "I frankly don't even know what AGI means. Like, people say you know it when you see it. I guess I haven't seen it."
Yeah. Yeah. We started talking about the definition of AI has become like all software.
Yep.
And the definition of AGI has become scary software in the future. So
it's Skynet, guys, run.
Yeah, she's a luminary, but she's also not the only one to say, like, or have a personal definition of AGI. A term means nothing to me when people say, have to say, my definition of AGI is when I ask it a special question I haven't asked any other model yet and it gets it right, I will believe it's AGI. The Turing test came and went. I can easily prompt ChatGPT or any other of these public models, Llama 3, whatever, to behave like a, you know, like I'm chatting with a person.
Yeah.
And way more convincing than... I mean, you can do special things where you're trying to, like, jailbreak it and stuff like that.
Well, but we talked about it. You got people working for, you know, ChatGPT now. So it's like, you know.
That's come and gone. Yeah, we're in the – the frog has boiled in the world of, like, the intelligence explosion. I'll go back to Life 3.0 by Max Tegmark. Great book. Intelligence is exploding at the rate of GPUs being plugged in, it seems. Mm-hmm. And we're in a it's different, very different, but I went to Phoenix over the weekend for a bachelor party, hung out with some friends, and took my first Waymo ride. That's a moment that I'm going to tell kids, grandkids about, of like, there was a time when I got in taxis and was scared of the driver sometimes and not scared of the driver, and then spoke to them and negotiated about the air conditioning and the music, and then got out and had to tap a phone or whatever. And then there was this one time I went to Phoenix and I got in and the car drove out and I was fascinated. I'm staring at the wheel and I don't know how it's figuring this out. And then, like, halfway into the 15-minute ride, I, like, absentmindedly looked out the window at, you know, the Arizona skyline, because I hadn't been there before. I was, like, looking up at the rocks, at the mountains.
Mm-hmm.
And then I caught myself, I'm like, I got used to a driverless car on the first trip. This was supposed to be scary the entire time. It was, like, frankly better than every Uber driver I've ever had.
I'm surprised you didn't bring a safety cone, honestly, like just in case, right? Like if you got to throw the safety cone on the hood of the car, like just in case, man, like.
Yeah, I mean, maybe I'm just more down for it than other people, but
No, I mean,
all the stats about how good this thing is and how it's more people crashing into it than it crashing into other people is like, no highways, sure, I'll jump in this thing, right?
likewise, I'm not gonna forget my first experience being in one of these robo taxis. Like I remember when Lyft was doing a, I had to go to Las Vegas, and Lyft was doing their like pilot at the time, and like when you open up the Lyft app, like you can request a human driver or you can request a robo taxi. Like, it was like an
Okay. In
option.
Vegas?
Like, yes. And they're like, it was
I
an
didn't know
option.
this.
So like you could actually pick one or the other. And you know, they wanted to obviously give people the choice just in case, you know, we're like, man, fuck that. I don't want a robot driving me around anywhere. But like I selected the robo taxi option and I got in the car and yeah, I was amazed at like how the car is driving and you know how like all of these complex mechanics in the driver's seat and passenger seat are functioning to make this car go and make this happen. And then you know similar experience happened to me like once I was done focusing specifically on that because it's about a 25 minute ride from the airport to the strip. I just started looking at the casinos. Like I'm just staring outside, like pretending like nothing's happened. And I'm just like, oh yeah, what are they doing over at the Excalibur? And like, you know, like I just got comfortable with it.
It's so okay, that experience is so clear and present, and like physical, because you're like sitting in the car and you're going somewhere. That same thing totally happened with ChatGPT. Not right away, because it would screw some stuff up, but like slowly over time, I was like, wow, like I don't need to think too much to write a long email. Like I talked about it earlier, writer's block, right? I got some ideas. I want to write something. I don't need to write the first sentence. I just prompt something and start editing. And it still feels like my voice. Maybe I'm using some different words now that I wouldn't have thought of, but at a high level, like the world has changed, and it wasn't this like one day when the lights got switched on and all of a sudden, it happened. I assume people who were there for the dawn of the internet felt the same way. Like one day they sent a message to somebody in another country and that came back pretty quickly, and then they were in a chat room, and then all of a sudden every company has a website. Like, how did that happen?
I think
Smartphones,
you're,
right?
yeah, smartphones. It's happened with every disruptive technology where it seems on the, at least on the onset, like, wow, this is crazy. I can't believe this is possible. And then with, you know, depending on the how disruptive the technology is to your daily life, it then just becomes commonplace or like an extension of you. I don't know if I talked about this on a previous episode, and I hope nobody from our marketing department's listening, but every time I get requests for a, you know, synopsis or a summary of a presentation that I'm going to give, I haven't written a single one since ChatGPT came out because what's the point? Right? Like, why am I going to spend time writing that when I could literally prompt ChatGPT to do a much better job than me? And then I send that in an email and people respond and they go, oh my God, that's so great. Well, you know, what a great, like, really looking forward to this presentation. And I'm thinking in my head, like, yeah, thank ChatGPT because I sure as hell didn't write this.
Okay, two things. Have you done your performance review yet?
I have. Yeah, I did that last night at 7 p.m. after I had worked 12 fucking hours.
Yeah,
So I was.
so watch out for those self-performance reviews. They're going to be a little longer than previous years. And the other one I saw is somebody's generating PowerPoint slides. They're generating VBA code to generate PowerPoint slides right now. So I got to figure out how to
Oh
start
man.
prompting.
That is an absolute game changer for my job. Like we need we
Start prompting those PowerPoint squares and stuff. Like I always want to use the online stuff like Figma or equivalents to create these little diagrams, because everybody's visual and you want to do it. I end up doing drag and drop with these PowerPoint things. I'm going to be speaking to a model to generate VBA code to start making PowerPoint slides soon. Just wait, just wait. We're working on it. We're working on it.
Well, I think with that, that wraps our that wraps this week's episode. I look forward to generating all of the PowerPoints that I have to generate for these presentations and not spending hours doing them myself.
Good job, man. Talk to you next week.
All right. Sounds good. See you.